That's very good.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Peaked the mic there.
Welcome to the pre-dead boys. Yeah! Woo!
What happens when we record before 8 p.m.?
Welcome to the pre-dead boys. It's a podcast about the history and culture of death and decomposition. I'm Dorian. Woo! Yeah! With me, as always, is Max.
Woo!
I'm doing a big stretch right now.
Suck!
Man, the crowd tonight, real rough crowd.
Getting into that World Cup spirit.
We need that weird horn that they've been playing in the
background.
Vuvuzela? It doesn't sound like a vuvuzela. It sounds like the Lord of the Rings soundtrack, where it's like... and...
Like the Gondor thing? Is that the horn of Gondor?
Something. It doesn't sound like the constant like swarm of bees that vuvuzelas typically sound like to me.
But... We're really... launching this one off correctly.
There we go. That's it. That's an intro. We don't need any more banter. Well, not with that crowd intro.
Not with that crowd intro.
Wow. Welcome to our first live show.
Well, I mean, to part the curtain behind our creative process.
To part the bedsheet.
It's July 4th as we're recording.
Right.
And it's like 1, and I just finished a lot of coffee.
Yeah, I slammed a couple shots of espresso myself.
That was a big boy.
Woo! That's a lot of coffee.
Yeah. So we are going to be a high-energy, riled-up episode.
Yes.
It's going to sound like you're listening to it on 1.5 speed. I don't know. I'm excited to go drink some beers and sit in the grass and blow some stuff up.
Yeah, I'm just excited to not be at work. I got a run in this morning, and now we're recording.
It's very hot.
Yeah, I think that did not help my continuously sweating problem that I'm having right now. So every week, Max prepares a little something for us to learn about, and it's usually about death. Are we going to talk about death today? Where are we going to talk?
We are.
Okay.
We are.
Excellent.
We're going to drop a little bit back into art today, not the art that you see there on your screen.
Yeah, thank you for putting in the show notes this festive image of an Uncle Sam skeleton aiming a gun at me for some reason.
I like to, real aggressive. I like to prevent Dorian from getting the topic spoiled by putting an image at the first page of his show notes. So for this one, I googled patriotic skeleton. And the first thing is just a skeleton with some American flags as curtains held up by a femur that's pointing a gun. So I don't know why it's not just a skeleton like playing a fife and marching the Republic forth. But
yeah, why is it that all artwork... skeletons. All these skeletons are just real rude to us. I'm starting to take it personally.
Well, we've kept the skeletons entrapped inside of us the whole time.
Let me out. This guy sucks ass.
So today we're going to be dropping back into art, as I mentioned.
Yes.
We've had a couple art-themed episodes.
Mm-hmm.
Music, performance, longevity art. You know, you went to an art college.
Yes.
I've seen art before. I think that qualifies us to speak on this topic.
It's worth every bit as much as an art degree.
Now, you are a fan of the cinema, correct?
Oh, yeah.
What's the best movie you've seen this year?
Hereditary, almost certainly.
Yeah.
I've had a couple movie-going experiences where I'm like, damn, that might be my favorite movie of the year. But Hereditary is up there. I like being freaked out, and I got proper freaked out.
Did you see Quiet Place?
Yeah. I thought that was going to be my favorite horror movie of the year. And then Hereditary came out.
It was like, oh no.
We're in a great golden age of fantastic horror movies. I'm very excited.
And like concept horror too. Like we've kind of gotten away from slashers.
Yeah.
But it's like, you know, high concept horror at this point.
Yeah. Although I got to give a little bit of a shout out. I think it was last year that Happy Death Day came out. Have you heard about this?
It's just, someone told me it was like Groundhog Day.
Yeah, this girl keeps getting murdered, and then every time she gets murdered, she wakes up at the beginning of her birthday. And so it's just Groundhog Day, if it were a real corny horror movie. Just slasher movie. It's very half-assed acting and real dorky. Just not a great movie, but it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I should see it. I had like a kid at work tell me about it, and I was like, well, you're 12, so I'm not going to believe you that this movie is good.
Yeah. It's not quality, but it's fun, and it's a great use of 90 minutes.
Yeah, I'm going to have to scope that.
But see Hereditary first, please. You kind of told me that you weren't going to see Hereditary until you saw Jurassic World 2 a couple times. Can we reflect on that? Like, do you stand by that decision? What are your thoughts now that you've seen it one time?
Jurassic World 2 fucking sucked. It made me very angry. I thought about walking out and leaving the theater. Bear in mind that I saw this movie 2 weeks ago, and I'm still angry about it.
Wow. It stuck with you.
Yeah. 4 weeks when this is recorded, and I guarantee I will still think it fucking sucked 4 weeks from now.
So you'd say it was an emotionally powerful film that sticks with you.
When the dinosaur cries a tear.
Oh, that's dumb.
That was the point when I broke, and I was just like, well, this is bad.
Couldn't even enjoy it anymore.
No, it was a tough one.
So yeah, that's our film review segment of the episode.
Well, you'd think that, but actually we're going to do film review for the entirety of the episode.
Oh, all right.
Because this week's topic is death in movies.
Yes.
And how we deal with that. So without further ado, let's crack into the topic with the pre-Dead Boys crack into the topic moment. Still unsponsored by LaCroix.
Oh, Lemon. That's a good one.
It's kind of a B-side. I like it a lot.
It's a B-side, kind of like you know, Converge came out with a new EP.
Oh, hell
this
yeah.
week, and it was just songs that didn't make the cut off of their last full length, but yeah. They're all still really good songs.
Yeah.
That's what Lemon is.
Yeah, Lemon, it's like...
Lemon is the compilation of B-sides that didn't make the cut to the classic that is...
Pamp.
Pamp, I don't know. Pure. I'm running out of ways to describe LaCroix. When will they give us money?
So, since we're talking about death in movies today... Do you have any favorite on-screen deaths or movies about death?
One of my favorite examples of how death is handled in a movie is from a movie that's not even that good.
Uh-huh.
Have you ever seen Way of the Gun?
No.
It's like...
God, I'm Benicio... just listening to you talk right now, and this episode is going to be directly up your alley. It rules.
Awesome. I'm excited, because I can just dork out about movies all day. Way of the Gun has a couple critical, excellent scenes in it, but it's kind of... up its own butt. It's a little pretentious and overwrought writing, and it's definitely not the best movie I've ever seen. But
like
there's a few
like
things.
A Western or
it's kind of it was made I think in like the mid to late 90s or maybe early 2000s, but it's starring Ryan Phillippe and Benicio del Toro. There's money and a bunch of people double crossing and backstabbing each other to get the money.
Okay.
Kind of plot.
Yeah.
It wants very badly to be a Tarantino movie, but it's not nearly as well written or well directed. But there's a couple things that they handle really well in that movie.
Huh.
And chief among them, I remember every time a character dies, they show a shot of the character dying. And if memory serves, you don't see anyone, like in a lot of movies, someone gets shot and they go, and then their eyes are closed, they're not moving,
yeah.
It's whatever. There's a lot of scenes in that movie where someone gets shot and they're clearly going to die, like they got shot in the throat or some mortal wound that obviously kills them. But the camera lingers on them for a few seconds while they are dying, and it's usually locked in on like the last facial expression that they have that they're making at the character who killed them.
Uh-huh.
And it's kind of like you don't actually see consciousness leave characters' bodies when they are clearly murdered.
And so, the removal of the camera from being focused on that character is when they die, or...?
I guess that's one way to look at it, but it's just, it stuck with me. It's a little haunting when you see someone get shot and they're just looking hatefully at the person who killed them, or looking at them with surprise, and you never see the over-the-top, like, I don't think people actually
die that way,
where they get shot and they just instantly, like, poof.
Like Wilhelm screams and all that.
Right, or, like, they close their eyes and they're, like, at peace and just...
Yeah.
I just think of the classic melodramatic, like, someone's dying in someone else's arms, And they're like, tell my wife I love her. And they turn to the side and very conveniently die, just putting a cap on the scene. But death in that movie was handled really interestingly in a way that kind of stuck with me. You know, it's messy too.
Yeah.
It's got a lot of messy violence that's not very pretty, and it's just a lot of selfish people killing each other for money. So, entertaining. I give it a pretty half-hearted recommendation, but it has some pretty cool parts.
Yeah. I went the opposite, and I think my favorite movie death is when the last android dies in Blade Runner.
Ooh, yeah.
His name is Roy, and they're in the rain, and he's, like, giving that really extended speech.
Yeah.
And it's just, like, this weird monologue about seeing the ships fade out and, like, the Kuiper Belt or the Rings of Saturn or something like that.
Right.
And it's raining. It's really beautiful, but it's, like, maybe the most melodramatic thing that exists.
One thing I really love about that scene in particular is, sorry to spoil Blade Runner, it's been out for many, many decades now, so...
Yeah, come on.
I guess go see it. But when he dies, it's kind of almost shocking because the whole movie is basically Harrison Ford's character being a bounty hunter and, like, hunting down these androids.
Yeah.
And you kind of feel like the movie is building maybe to a big climactic fight between the two of them. But it's like this android kind of manhandles Harrison Ford and throws him around. And
yeah, that big old, like, on the abandoned verge. Building.
Yeah, and is even on the verge of killing the main character.
Yeah.
But his time runs out.
Yeah.
Like, that's essentially the death of that character, is just his allotted time as an android is just kind of out. And death takes its course in kind of a more natural way than just stylish, choreographed murder scenes.
Yeah, it almost just kind of fizzles in a way.
Yeah. And you're left with all of these things, like, yeah, it's really, you know, maybe pretentious and overly epic, but it's kind of remarkable that the last thing that the movie leaves you with this character is just his memories and what he's seen and experienced, and then he's gone.
Yeah. Yeah, Blade Runner rules. It's one of my favorites. I love that film.
Yeah. I also really love Edward James Olmos, I think is the actor's name, his last line. It's too bad the girl won't live, but then again, who does?
Yeah, it's delivered really weirdly. Like, Goff is his name, I think.
Yeah, I yell that at, like, friends and coworkers completely out of context, and they don't really appreciate it.
Death has undergone a long evolution in movies that mirrors a lot of similarities in American culture as a whole. When movies were starting to get more complex in the early 1900s with the advent of sound and deeper plot elements, more than just, like, Charlie Chaplin stood by a house and it fell over on him. And movies were starting to deal with death. Things were pretty safe, to say the least.
Early on, death was kept out of the movies. Cancer was a stigma deriving from something bad in your karma. And a culture of euphemism prevailed until surprisingly recently. If a character died of a terminal disease in movies from the 1930s to the 1970s, it was more often than not some sanitized, entirely symptomless ailment, one that left the body quite free of ravages. No buboes, no lesions, no vomiting blood into a bedpan, no adult diapers, no skeletal remnant, no gargling death rattle. In fact, in many early films, one might have been forgiven for never realizing what a protagonist was dying of. The only symptoms common to the deaths in these movies seem to be extreme soft focus and an ethereally gentle and diffuse light around the deathbed.
So it sounds almost like the opposite of Way of the Gun.
Right. It's very prettied up and dramatic.
Yeah. And there are a few competing theories as to why this happened. So starting around the 1930s, American life as we knew it started to change. As transportation became more accessible and cities grew, it was no longer uncommon to move away from your family in the town you grew up in into a big city. So what this did is it left a lot of older folks who previously would have been cared for by the younger people in their family kind of adrift.
Hmm.
We never really had a generation left without dedicated care by the younger people, and this is how the hospice industry got started. So, you know, death became more and more removed from the lives of people who were living in the cities, you know, people who movies were being made for.
Mm-hmm.
If you were living in a city, you wouldn't be caring for a sick grandparent. They would just die in a nursing home or hospital. But you might have a lot of guilt from, like, abandoning them.
Right.
So some people think that Hollywood was making this image of death in movies very sanitized and nice to alleviate some of that guilt.
Yep.
The other theory is kind of the opposite, where since death in movies starts around the 1930s and 40s, we were dealing with World War II at the time.
Mm.
And there was a ton of death that right. was really brutal. And it wasn't uncommon for you to know, like, 7 to 10, 20 to 30-year-old people who had gone overseas and been killed in right. war.
Yeah, so having this very prettied up scene where people are passing very peacefully and cleanly, yeah, that sounds a lot better than dying in a trench or
yeah.
dying from a bombing or some of the horrific things that you saw in World War One and Two, really.
Yeah, that ties in with the escapist theory of movies where... if you're going to a movie to escape from the fact that, like, the Great Depression is happening and everyone's starving and World War II is going on and people are being gassed, why would you want to see horrible things like that
right.
happening? The thing that really switched this very nice sanitary idea of death in movies to a much more brutal one and kind of what we have today was exploitation films and grindhouse cinema.
Hell so, yeah.
For those not familiar with exploitation films, which I know we both are.
Woo! Fun stuff.
Fun stuff. This is like a brief description of what they are.
The 1960s and 1970s marked the golden age of the independent B-movie, made outside of Hollywood's major film studios. As censorship pressures lifted in the early 1960s, the low-budget end of the American motion picture industry increasingly incorporated the sort of sexual and violent elements long associated with so-called exploitation films.
Yeah, I really love just corny, campy, hyper-violent for the time 60s and 70s movies.
Yeah.
And I know you're a big kung fu guy.
Yes, love all this stuff. I love blood and I love sex.
So exploitation films were commonly screened in big theaters... normally in a back-to-back-to-back role.
Right.
Because all these movies were like 58 minutes long. So they were like, we just got to keep people in here. So we'll just show three movies and charge them admission three times.
Oh, okay. Nice. Before there was binge-watching television shows,
yeah.
there was sitting down for a grindhouse triple feature.
Yeah. And I attached some photos here of some grindhouse marquees.
Oh, yeah.
Which is just some like really packed out titles.
Yeah, Billy Chong is a one-man army, a fistful of talons. Also, Kung Fu Zombie. Real quick, do you know about this movie coming out? The Man Who Killed Hitler and then the Bigfoot?
No.
Yeah, that's coming out, I think,
what?
This year.
Yeah. Is it like a campy throwback thing?
It's gotta be. I mean, it's got a cast that's kind of impressive. Ron Livingston. And Sam Elliott is the man, the titular man.
Weird.
We'll get to glimpse that pretty soon. I'm excited about that. Just speaking of camp.
Oh, man, that's going to get me out of my Jurassic World 2 rut. That's an incredible title.
Yeah.
I really love old B-movie titles as well, like Samurai Cop.
Yeah.
Have you seen that one?
No, I've heard of it.
Very good. Chopping Mall is very good.
I'm sorry, did you mean shopping mall?
No. No, chopping mall.
Oh. Oh. What gets chopped?
People.
Oh. Heavens.
Do you have any good B-movie titles off the top of your head?
I just think of my favorite B-movies, and a lot of them don't even have great titles. But, like, have you ever seen Duel to the Death?
No.
Yeah, real generic name, right?
Uh-huh.
But it's basically, like, ninja battles, and there's these ninjas that fly in on kites. It's very silly and very entertaining. I highly recommend it.
And that's like, you know, for as much as we're about racial sensitivity and not being a total darsh to other cultures, some of those old movies where it's like, the entirety of Japan is just an island full of ninjas and samurai that are flying around on kites.
Yeah, if you are a fan of this genre, of just any kind of exploitation movies, you do have to come to terms with that fact.
Like, yeah.
These are very entertaining and very silly. But you cannot base your understanding off of, for example, Japan or Southeast Asia in general. You cannot base that exclusively off of movies, I think in general, of any
yeah.
genre of movie. But especially so when it comes to movies that were basically churned out to entertain audiences
yeah.
with blood and sex and shocking material.
Yeah. it's outrageous. There are some classics in there. And speaking of classics, I moved this bit around a bit. If you want to reach around the couch...
Oh, we're back to the couch gag. Here we go.
Back on the trap.
How far back is it?
Well, it shouldn't be too far back.
Is it under the couch?
No, it's on the side.
This will definitely get edited. Oh, yeah! Chilling Classics 50 Movie Pack!
Yeah, I love that we're in an era where I can buy 50 horror movies on two-sided DVDs.
Yes.
With just some corny names.
How much did you pay for this? Like
$20.
$3.
It was in a Walmart bin. If you want to break off some of the titles and then maybe read some of the descriptions of these horror exploitation films.
Yeah. Let's crack this bad boy open. Crack into the topic.
Featuring this Walmart DVD collection.
Let's talk about Bell from Hell. A young man is released after many years from a mental institution after his aunt had him committed so she could take his inheritance. What a shit. The man arrives back home into the care of the aunt and her three daughters. The aunt and cousins hope to drive him insane in order to permanently take away his money, but the young man has plans of revenge for his greedy relatives. Cool. 93 minutes. Unrated.
Yeah. Can you read the description of the film The Driller Killer?
Driller Killer. A struggling artist is trying to complete his latest painting when he finds himself distracted by a punk rock band that moves into the downstairs apartment and continuously plays its music. Damn punks!
Punks.
He finally finishes his masterpiece despite the noise and shows it to his art dealer, but is devastated when the dealer laughs at his work. Driven over the edge by the dealer's criticisms and the band's loud music, the artist snaps and begins killing people using a large power drill as his weapon of choice. 96 minutes. Color. Unrated.
Just corny stuff like that.
Yeah. Dude, this one stars Christopher Lee. Horror Express.
What goes on in that one?
Well, Max, I'm glad you asked. In 1907, a scientist discovers the figure of a creature embedded in the ice of Manchuria. Believing it to be the missing link, the scientist has the ice block loaded onto a Trans-Siberian train for a trip across the continent with the eventual destination of London and the unveiling of the discovery. While traveling through a snowstorm in Siberia, the creature is freed from the ice and begins to terrorize the passengers, while the scientist and his rival discover the creature is not what it appears to have been. Color, 90 minutes, rated R.
This is great stuff.
There is a G-rated one in here called The Legend of Bigfoot.
That's like a documentary or something, right?
Yeah, almost certainly.
Just stellar work here.
Yeah, you can definitely tell, like, there's, I'm sure, all kinds of problematic things across all of these movies.
Just full schlock.
Yeah.
But as outrageous as all these sound, they are art, and a studio paid for them to be made.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was the fulfillment of someone's artistic vision. It's also really cool.
Yes.
But they were still a way for filmmakers at the time to grapple with a changing cultural ethos that was much more violent.
Right.
Critical opinion has always been kind of divided on the role of violence in movies. But a film studies professor from Indiana University sums it up here.
Film critics analyzing violent film images that seek to aesthetically please the viewer mainly fall into two categories. Critics who see the depictions of violence in film as superficial and exploitative argue that it leads audience members to become desensitized to brutality, thus increasing their aggression. On the other hand, critics who view violence as a type of content or as a theme claim it is cathartic and provides acceptable outlets for antisocial impulses.
Kind of reminds me of a little bit of our death metal episode.
Yeah, totally.
Where these dudes in bands are like, yeah, I'm just doing this to get some energy out, and it's an emotional release for me, and that's what we want these kids listening to this to feel as well.
Yeah.
You know? I don't know particularly what side of the argument that I fall into with this, but I do know that because of these movies, death and violence in films got huge. One of the biggest franchises that dealt with this stuff was Faces of Death.
Oh, man.
Have you ever seen the box art for this thing?
No, I haven't. Oh, that's very cool. Dude, that lettering is incredible, honestly. Faces of Death. Sorry, it's the illustrator in me is dorking out like, wow, but like look at how well Kern and
it's banned in 46 countries.
Damn.
Now, have you ever seen a Faces of Death film?
I've seen some segments. Let me tell you, I'm definitely in the latter camp where I do think that violence expressed in art can, for the most part, be cathartic. I think sometimes it is over the top in ways that can kind of encourage violent behavior, and I don't really dig that. But on the whole, I'm pretty cool with violence handled well in art. Faces of Death, I don't really dig this. I'm not a fan.
Yeah, I've never plucked up the courage to watch it.
Yeah.
I even felt kind of skeeved out reading it. I had friends who watched it.
Right.
The whole thing. Again, for those who aren't familiar, here's its deal.
Faces of Death really became a phenomenon in 1983 when the infamous Gorgon Video Company released it on a garish big box VHS with its crude drawing of a grinning skull on a pitch black background with the impossible to resist tagline. Banned in 46 countries! As soon as you saw it, you knew you had to watch it. Faces was arguably the first real viral video.
Yeah, so I remember one of my friends, Jordan...
when you were a kid in 1983?
As a kid in, 1995. Like, his dad had it or
right,
something like that.
Right.
Probably not 95. We would have been, probably, 97 or 98.
Yeah.
But his dad had a copy that was just transferred onto, a Betamax or Maxell tape.
Whoa, okay.
That was just, in his VHS cabinet.
Yeah.
And it was, do not watch written on it.
How could you resist that?
I know. That was, a thing where it's, there's no way any kid would be able to be, Faces of Death, that sounds cool.
Right.
And then you get to it and you're like, oh, man. Faces of Death, it was a franchise eventually.
Yeah.
They churned out 5 or 6 of these. But it was created by a guy named John Alan Schwartz, who... apparently, when he was coming up with the Faces of Death movies in the 70s, was roommates with David Hasselhoff.
Huh. Okay.
They were just buds and lived together in the mid-70s before either of them got big.
That's an unlikely combo.
Right? But apparently, he was inspired by a lot of Japanese art films that were coming over to the kind of film student realm at the time and were pretty death positive, as we can see from this quote.
In the late 70s, John Alan Schwartz was working for an entertainment company owned by the family whose name he politely declines to divulge. He was editing an animal documentary when a Japanese crew came in. They wanted to make a movie about death. Society doesn't like to look at death, Schwartz says. The Japanese, he says, are totally fascinated with death and the macabre. Not the way we are. We take a look and then turn away.
So even that quote is a little exploitative, where he's like, oh, the Japanese are all about death.
Right.
The only thing.
All Japanese.
But it does make sense, with the difference in cultures. Japan is much more family-based, so death was a much more common thing they would experience.
Okay. Certainly more than here in America, where it was getting more commonplace to move away from family.
Yeah, for stuff to be distanced and things like that.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know how accurate that is in Japanese media. If all Japanese movies at the time were hyper-violent or even just death-focused. But Schwartz kind of took this idea and escalated it to an uncomfortably high level.
Yeah.
I know Faces of Death, I, again, couldn't bring myself to watch any of this. But it features scenes of a dogfight.
Right.
An electric chair execution. People eating monkey brains, an alligator attack, and a, quote, satanic cult cannibal ritual. Now, the article that I read all this stuff in also mentioned that, 30 years later, it's a few years ago, they released a anniversary edition of Faces of Death with interviews with a bunch of the people. And a lot of them were like, yeah, it was pretty much all entirely effects and grainy camera work and stuff like that. I guess the dogfight... they just rubbed jelly and jam on a bunch of the dogs' faces.
Aww.
And then, shook a camera around as the dogs were playing.
Oh, that is so cute.
Right?
I love that.
I still don't have the guts to watch it, but it's nice to think about.
Look at these savage animals tear each other apart, and they're just like...
yeah, they're just like still like playing because they're big puppies.
Oh, I love it.
The execution was apparently a big special effects thing.
Okay.
Because the guy starts bleeding from his eyes, which does not happen.
Yeah.
The monkey brains were cauliflower, apparently.
Okay. Man, you're really spoiling the magic of Faces of Death, man.
Yeah, I don't...
I was really excited to watch all of this exploitative footage of murder and whatnot.
But I guess they did pull some, like, actual footage of people dying.
Right, they mixed it in there.
And, you know, that was a thing that was accessible on the internet. And I have since left that part of my life behind.
Yeah.
Where I'm like, oh, this dude fell into some train tracks.
Right.
And I'm not sad that I've left that part of my life behind.
You're probably happier.
Oh, significantly happier.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you're a kid and you're watching this on a grainy translated Betamax tape, and you're like, oh, is this real?
Right.
Like, I imagine it would be pretty jarring.
Yeah.
And it kind of demonstrates the fascination with death that a lot of people have. And Faces was legitimately one of the first movies to really sell out to that and start making a lot of money off it.
Mm-hmm.
So not all movies about death were absurd and brutal as Faces was, though. Have you ever seen Seventh Seal?
No, I haven't. That's Ingmar Bergman, right?
It is. It is, yeah. So you haven't, but you'll definitely recognize the motif that is present throughout the movie.
In death.
Yeah, of death being this black cowled, pale faced,
big old forehead.
Big old forehead spindly man.
Yeah, very iconic.
Yeah, almost like a gentleman image of death.
Yeah.
Where it's not this...
It's not this skeleton pointing a fucking gun at me, telling me that I suck ass or something. Yeah. Like, half the internet has convinced me that skeletons do.
Yeah, so, like, death in Seventh Seal is personified very normally.
Yeah.
You know? He's a character who follows a knight around. The movie's Swiss, and it takes place in Denmark after the Crusades and the Black Death had kind of eradicated pretty much everyone living there. So this knight returns from the Crusades, and he's walking around Denmark, and he's just seeing all of this devastation and chaos,
mm-hmm.
and death eventually comes for him. And what he does is he has a conversation with death, and he strikes a deal with death. He's like, let's play a game of chess, and for as long as the game of chess goes on, I'm allowed to live.
Hmm.
So the whole movie is him kind of wandering through the countryside while death will pop up at points and just play chess with him.
Okay. So they take breaks from chess.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah. The movie's not just a big, long chess game.
I will let you live for as long as this game of Settlers of Catan continues.
And then you just sit there and go,
That sounds like hell. I'm pretty sure that's what hell is. It's just being stuck in the same Catan game for forever.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's what Bergman was almost trying to illustrate through Seventh Seal. So here's a review of the film from The Guardian.
The sense of a vanishing future creates a kind of dementia of despair. The plague was the kind of calamity that drove people apart rather than pulled them together. Fear of contagion means that peasants abandon their fields. Stonemasons, their cathedrals, and parents, their children. Nobody knew what it was or how it spread, and we wouldn't for the next 500 years. As to the question why, people look to the Book of Revelation and its mystical imagery, which supplies the film's title, and blame the wrath of God. The why God was angry was also unknowable. Divine anger, so great that it contemplated the extermination of man, did not bear close examination.
So what Bergman was trying to reflect with his film here was a lot of the feelings of extermination and senseless violence that came with the Holocaust and World War II.
Yeah.
So rather than making a World War II movie, he looked to the last huge, awful disaster that wiped out a huge percentage of the European population and set his movie then. So you see Bergman trying to come up with an explanation for the mass death that Europe had just seen. And Seventh Seal is a movie that takes a long, hard look at what it means to be nothing and to be really nihilistic. And it's a fantastic mirror for how European people at the time were dealing with this huge, you know, existential ordeal they had just gone through.
Right.
Some people say that Seventh Seal is one of the films that best details humanity's wrestling with existence and purpose. You know what one of the other big ones is?
What's that?
Almost the exact opposite movie, Groundhog Day.
Okay. Are we about to talk about Groundhog Day?
For a little bit. I love Groundhog Day.
Yeah. How much do you love Groundhog Day? Why don't you tell our listeners?
It's Stockholm Syndrome.
Why don't you tell them what you did last February?
A local theater here in Columbus does a Groundhog Day marathon every year. Mm-hmm. Where you go in and for 24 hours straight, you watch Groundhog Day 12 times. So you watch the film and then you take a 15-minute break and then you're back in the theater watching the movie again. So you just go over and over and over this movie, which I think is good. I don't know if I think it's good or if I've been tricked by familiarity.
Yeah. Would you say that you understand, like, you know, this quote from the review for Seven Seal, where he's talking about a kind of dementia of despair? Does that sound familiar? Or
it sounds familiar around, like, so it starts at 2 p.m.
Yeah.
And goes till 2 p.m. the next day. And around 8 a.m., as I was, like, leaving the theater between one of the breaks and the sun was coming up.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, oh, God, like, I've wasted an entire day of my life and there's still six more hours to go.
Right.
That was a dementia of despair that I was feeling.
Yeah.
Because you're also not allowed to sleep.
Ugh.
Like, people, like, nudge you awake and you have to stand up every hour and a half and move around.
Yeah.
Ugh.
That's brutal.
But people love it, and there's a lot of reflection of religious themes that people say are in it, and I tend to agree with it.
Yeah.
Because Harold Ramis, who directed the movie, was raised agnostic, but in a Jewish family. Mm-hmm. And then I believe he married a Christian woman, but then got into Buddhism. So he has this kind of mix of a lot of world religions.
Yeah.
And
a good
values.
Sampler of
yeah.
different concepts.
And I think Ramis himself said that the movie is a reflection of this concept in Buddhist theology where it takes 10,000 years for the soul to evolve to the next level.
Okay.
So Bill Murray is stuck in the time loop for 10,000 years.
Okay, yeah.
And he only like moves past that when his soul stops living for himself and he starts helping other people out.
Yeah.
More than he's looking out for himself. It's really neat.
Yeah.
So
interesting.
Yeah, it's goofy reading all these articles and being like, oh, Seventh Seal and also Groundhog Day are these major religious movies in the 1900s.
Right. The intended mood of the person who would see either of these movies. It's very different.
Yeah. But it's not only old horror and drama movies that deal with death. You know who actually does it a lot these days?
Who's that?
Disney and Pixar.
That's true.
Right?
Yeah. I saw Coco a few weeks ago. I think I told you I saw Coco.
Yeah.
And that was, yeah, that's pretty heavy in
yeah.
some spots. A lot of death.
But
not a lot of death, but you know what I mean.
It's focused around that.
Right.
And then you have Bambi's mom dying. Mufasa.
She dies? No, I'm just
Bambi's
kidding.
Mom does die. I'm sorry. Mufasa.
Right.
Dies like a very violent death.
Yeah.
Like he's...
Stampede,
he doesn't. It's
trample.
Not like Bambi where it's off screen. Like he's murdered.
Yeah, straight up.
It's pretty brutal. And then you have Up.
Yeah.
Where like...
First 10 minutes of the movie, huh?
Is just kind of like a death retrospective.
Yep.
And it's gut-wrenching.
Yeah.
But they're all marketed to kids.
Right.
So in 2017, researchers Kelly Tenzik and Bonnie Nichols at the University of Buffalo did some research into death and Disney and Pixar movies and published a really interesting paper titled End of Life in Disney and Pixar Films. An opportunity for engaging in difficult conversation. So they believe that these films are actually excellent opportunities to have conversations with kids about really heavy topics.
Tenzik says, these films can be used as a conversation starter for difficult and what are oftentimes taboo topics like death and dying. These are important conversations to have with children, but waiting until the end of life is way too late and can lead to a poor end-of-life experience. Starting the end-of-life conversation with children early allows the dialogue to continue and develop throughout their lives. And the deaths in these films can actually help children relate to and understand death in ways that otherwise might be very challenging for them.
Yeah, it's interesting stuff.
Yeah.
Like, basically what they're putting forth is that it's better for a kid to see a character's death in a movie like The Lion King or Up and be able to have a dialogue about that with your kid or any kid. before they have to experience the death of a parent, grandparent, or friend in real life. You know, so you kind of move the conversation from the realm of the imaginary and artistic into the real world, and that helps develop coping skills. It's neat.
Yeah.
They based their research off of some earlier stuff, but they expanded it and came up with four types of conversations that parents could have with their kids about death in movies.
The new analysis yielded four general opportunities or themes on which to base an end-of-life discussion. First, some of the portrayals of death are unrealistic, such as when the character returns or returns in an altered form. But this is a chance for a child to better understand the difference between fiction and real life. Second, Tenzik says managing the end of life or the emotional response to death could be helpful for children and adults. She says, quote, "How the characters portray their responses to dying can help children understand the nature of expressing emotion. Big Hero 6 and Inside Out specifically address emotional responses to death and dying, which were not present in earlier films." End quote. The third and fourth themes, dealing with intentions to kill and transformation and spiritual connection with its moral sub-theme, are more complex. Religious and spiritual content are not always overly present in Disney and Pixar films. However, Tenzik says, the films can still serve as opportunities to discuss religious beliefs and end of life.
Yeah, so these films are serving as a way for you to talk to your kid about what it might mean when a character dies, or why Scar is so angry at Mufasa to the point where he decides to kill him.
Right.
You know? And it's an interesting way to not just, like, shield a kid from the reality that everything dies,
mm-hmm.
but to introduce them to that and be able to have a conversation about, how did this make you feel? What do you think about this? While it's still fictional and hopefully less scary than an actual loved one dying.
Right. That's something that I think parenting is probably a little down the road for me. It's not quite happening anytime soon. But that's something that I definitely aspire to when I am a parent. And now that I'm mentoring a kid and doing youth work, I think it's pretty easy for us to just consume entertainment without talking about how does it make us feel?
Yeah.
And what are things we can learn from it? And, you know, if something's kind of rubbing us the wrong way in a movie, it's worth investigating that, I think, especially with children.
Oh, yeah.
You know, when you're in a really developmental stage of life and growing in your understanding of things. And it's kind of cool that we don't need faces of death to do that.
Yeah.
You know, I was thinking about that, like, that could be used for terror management, you know, that watching something like that does tune you into death in a pretty real way. But, you know, that can be achieved in more subtle ways, even just with Disney films, where
it's
not the violence in and of itself that you need to see to be reminded of death and mortality.
Yeah.
That, you know, there are more nuanced and maybe better ways than just watching rampant,
rampant violence
snuff films.
But that's a cool thing about the death positive movement as a whole, is that it's not just like people go, oh, so you just like watch really violent stuff and like talking about people dying. It's like, well
yes, that's true. But also
partially granted. Yes. I will give you that.
Yeah.
But also like, you know, it's a thing that it was taboo for a long time. But since death is a universal topic, it can be a really tough developmental thing to get around if you're not having these hard conversations with kids at an age where they're approaching having to deal with that at some point. And it's cool seeing this community, you know, really embrace a really novel way of communicating that reality in a way that's helpful and is going to empower that kid to be a better person and better able to deal with that down the line.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's neat.
Yeah.
So, you know, we started in a pretty dark place, but have moved to a more positive ending.
This is very cool stuff. You scratched an itch for me. I love talking about movies. Thanks for doing that research, Max.
Yeah, no worries at all.
Thank you for listening to this episode. It was a fun one to make. Hey, if you want to support the podcast, there's a few different ways you can do that. You can leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, and we will give you a little shout on the next episode. If you're on any device, it helps a lot just having that word of mouth advertising.
Yeah.
So tell a friend about this episode. Tell a friend to listen to this one and talk about movies and then go watch a movie like The Driller Killer or something better than that, at least.
Lion King.
Yeah. Yeah, there you go.
Seventh Seal is genuinely very good.
I really want to see it.
Yeah, it's great.
They've got a Bergman retrospective going on at the Wexner Center.
Oh, really?
Yeah, this art museum and facility here in Columbus.
Very cool.
I don't know if I'll be able to catch that, but yeah, I definitely want to see Seventh Seal at some point. I feel like a poser if you talk about you like movies, but you haven't seen Bergman, but we'll get around to it.
Foundational text.
Yeah. Hey, tell us what you think about the podcast. We love hearing your feedback and suggestions on episode topics and other stuff we should talk about. You can follow us on Twitter and or Instagram. How about and Instagram? Follow us on both.
Double down.
Yeah. We're at Pre-Dead Boys. You can email us, predeadboys@gmail.com. You can join our Facebook group. Just search Pre-Dead Boys Podcast, and it'll be the first group that comes up. Again, still trying to figure out how Facebook pages work. I might just ignore it. I don't give a shit.
You can join the group, and you get some good toothpaste recommendations.
Yeah, shout out to Pre-Dead Jessica for the tooth tabs recommendation. I think I'm going to place an order of those.
Are you serious? Those things seem crazy.
They do. They're weird enough to try.
Do you chew it? Is it like gum?
I guess you chew it a couple times, and then you brush with it. She explained it. And I still don't get it. So I think I just have to experience it. But yeah, if you got any recommendations for anything, including toothpaste, let your pre-dead boys know. If you would like to help us pay for this podcast, offset some fees for hosting and some other costs and help us grow, we would really appreciate that. You can go to ko-fi.com/pre-dead boys. You can give us a tip of $3 or more. Our intro music is the song About Time by Brat Curse. Thanks to the Brat Curse boys for letting us use that one. Check them out at bratcurse.bandcamp.com.
Please.
And that's it. I think Max and I have a lot of films to catch up on here.
50, to be exact.
Where do we start? Jesse James Meets Frankenstein's Daughter or Messiah of Evil?
The Messiah of Evil sounds rad.
It's pretty intense. Starring Michael Greer. Think he's related to Pam Greer or anyone famous? Probably not.
That doesn't mean anything to me.
Yeah, that's fine. Anyway, we're going to go do that. Thanks for listening. Max and Dorian here reminding you, you're going to rot. Didn't skip out on the packaging there, did they?
No. It's like AOL free trial disc boxes. Yeah,
seriously. Can I read off a couple more descriptions?
Yeah, just break some off.
I want to follow my heart here.
This is good audio. I love this stuff.
Yeah. A bucket of blood. A nebbish waiter at a beatnik cafe longs to fit in with the artistic patrons, but he lacks the skills or personality.
Oh.
When he accidentally kills his landlady's cat and covers the body in plaster to hide his mistake, the result makes him a successful artist and part of the cafe group. Lacking the skills to make true artistic pieces, the waiter continues his methods when branching into human forms.
Uh-oh.
Stars Dick Miller. Black and white. 65 minutes. Unrated.
65 minutes.
Yeah, we could break that off tonight.
Just trying to get it out of there.
Yeah. This one's called I Eat Your Skin.
Oh.
A writer looking to research voodoo legends for an upcoming book. I'm sure that's handled delicately. The
very
voodoo,
tastefully.
The voodoo culture.
Nuanced.
Yeah. He arrives on a remote tropical island to investigate reports of zombies roaming the land. He soon discovers a scientist and his beautiful daughter living on the island. Creepy. Where the father is experimenting with a serum that has transformed some of the natives into strange-looking creatures. When the remaining natives decide to sacrifice the scientist's daughter to appease their voodoo gods, our writer must stop them and the scientist from causing any further harm. Black and white, 84 minutes, unrated. How about this one? It's called Naked Massacre. In Belfast.
Of course.
In Belfast, a group of 8 nurses share a home while working at various hospitals and clinics throughout the city. Entering into their lives is a crazed Vietnam veteran with a hatred for women who decides to take out his hatred on them. Stalking them one by one, the killer terrorizes and tortures the women while the authorities attempt to track him down. 86 minutes. G. Rated G. Wow.
What?
No, it's unrated.